When Prahlad replied that God resides everywhere, the father angrily asked whether his God was within one of the pillars of the palace, and the child said yes. At once the atheist king shattered the pillar in front of them to pieces, and the Lord instantly appeared as the Sringa, the half-man, half-lion incarnation, and killed the atheist king. Thus the Lord is within everything, and he creates everything by his different energies. So, Prabhupada goes on. Prabhupada makes the point a couple of lines further down. Oh, well, let's just carry on reading. It's just a few more lines. Through his inconceivable powers, he can appear at any place in order to favor his sincere devotee. Lord Nrisimha appeared from within the pillar, not by the order of the atheist king, but by the wish of his devotee. An atheist cannot order the Lord to appear, but the Lord will appear anywhere and everywhere to show mercy to his devotees. So, I mean, we could try it. Just like Hiranyakashipu, he smashed the pillar and the Lord appeared. So anyone could try it, smashing a pillar or a wall or smash something and see if the Lord comes out. But he's not going to. Even for us, I mean, if we could put it that way, even though we're devotees or trying to be or become. But we're not like Prahlad. When Prahlad said, oh yes, he's there, then the Lord felt, okay, I have to be there. And then Hiranyakashipu smashed the pillar and Lord Nrisimhadeva came out. But it was not, you know, like in a drama, in fact in our dramas when we do the same thing, that there's some actor waiting there in the pillar made of styrofoam which gets smashed and generally in a rather clumsy way he sort of comes out with pillar everywhere. And no, it wasn't that Lord Nrisimhadeva was waiting in the pillar. No. And it wasn't that Hiranyakashipu, because he was so determined in his demoniac way, forced the Lord to appear in the pillar. It was because Prahlad was saying, yes, of course, he's in the pillar. So therefore the Lord appeared like that. So by the power of the devotee's devotion, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, very mercifully, he appears through this Ishavasya principle, basically. Through the Ishavasya principle. And the more we become serious about Krishna consciousness, the more the Lord will appear in our lives as progressively more tangible reality. This we can expect. It's not like in Christianity, perhaps, or, you know, certain religions, popular religions, that you just believe and kind of, you know, keep your fingers crossed. And then you only find out when you die, and then it's too late if you're wrong. whether you were right or not. It's not like that. Just a matter of blindly believing, and there's really nothing terribly tangible otherwise. In Krishna consciousness, or following this Ishavasya principle, there's a progressive realization of Krishna more and more, which solidifies the devotee's faith as the devotee continues on. So the great devotees who have perfected the Ishavasya principle and realized what has been described in these two verses we just read, they're going to be described in the following three mantras, which we'll read tomorrow.
Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
So yesterday we went through Sri Upanishad up to the point of completing mantra 5. The first three mantras, or rather the invocation and mantras 1 and 2, were explaining the principle of completeness and the Ishavasya system which operates within that context of the completeness of everything within Krishna, and how nice that is. Then the next section, mantra 3, explained what it's like if you don't do that, if you don't follow the Ishavasya system, then your future is rather dim, rather unpleasant, going down into the lower species and lower planets. Then the next section, section 3, is mantras 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. So there are two subsections, basically, within that section. The first subsection we went through, that was mantras 4 and 5, which are explaining in a little more detail about the completeness of the Absolute Truth, or Krishna, and just a little more information about the Absolute Truth, really. How he is constituted, and how he is the Absolute Truth under all circumstances. Absolute indicates he's not relative. And in this sense, not relative means he's not dependent. He is always complete, and he's not dependent on any other thing other than himself. So he can be fixed in one place, which would appear to give him a relative position in regard to other places, but he's in those other places also. So he's not relative, he's absolute. So like this, mantras 4 and 5 were explaining how the complete absolute truth is really complete under all circumstances, and even particularly we were seeing in terms of circumstances which might otherwise or normally tend to indicate that he might not be complete. Like that. Bringing out contradictions or possible contradictions to the idea of him being complete and absolute, but showing how they're not contradictions. You follow the idea? Yeah. So now then, for the balance of this section, mantras 6, 7, and 8, there's going to be a further elaboration. This is like the second subsection within this third section. So the speaker is going to bring out more about the person who is following the Ishavasya system. The nature of the Ishavasya system, of course, was shown in mantra 1. Then mantra 2 was showing how wonderful the Ishavasya system is, the glories of the Ishavasya system, and our mantras 6, 7, and 8 are going to go into more detail about that, and more detail about people who are following it, and even, most particularly, those who have been following the Ishavasya system and have actually become perfect in it. And what are they like? What is their realization? What is their position? So this way it's quite important, an important section. And to begin with, as usual, we'll recite these verses together. On page 43. Yastu sarvani bhutani
Yastu sarvani bhutani
Atmanyeva nupasyati
Atmanyeva nupasyati
Sarva bhuteshu chatmanam
Sarva bhuteshu chatmanam
Tato na vijugupsate
Tato na vijugupsate.
He who sees everything in relation to the Supreme Lord, who sees all living entities as his parts and parcels, and who sees the Supreme Lord within everything, never hates anything or any being. So as Prabhupada says, you can just see there at the beginning of the purport, he says, this is a description of the Mahabhagavat, or in other words, the most advanced devotee, perfect devotee, someone who has become perfect in following this Ishavasya system. Then mantra 7 on page 49. Yasmin sarvani bhutani
Yasmin sarvani bhutani
Atmaiva bhut vijanata
Atmaiva bhut vijanata
Tatrako moha kashoka.
Tatrako moha kashoka.
Ekatvam anupasyata.
Ekatvam anupasyata.
One who always sees all living entities as spiritual sparks, in quality one with the Lord, becomes a true knower of things. What then can be illusion or anxiety for him? So this then, these two verses, 6 and 7 particularly, they are explaining the realization of the Mahabhagavat, the perfect follower of Ishvarasya, and also like the results, I mean within himself, how he feels, no illusion, no anxiety, doesn't hate anyone or anything. So like his heart, his feelings. And then mantra 8 is also continuing the same line of thought, page 55, describing this Mahabhagavat, most advanced devotee, but it's also giving just a little more elaboration. Well, it's stating very clearly that this very advanced devotee factually knows. In other words, he has actually realized as a tangible reality, not just in a theoretical sense or philosophical sense, but there's direct contact and direct perception of Krishna through following the Ishvarasya system and becoming perfect in it, and how, in what ways or in what forms, in what manifestations that advanced devotee is realizing Krishna. And of course this is one of those, at least the last line is a little tricky. The Sanskrit, anyway, we'll try. Saparyagach chukram akayam avranam. Asnaviram shudam apapa vidham. Kavir manishi paribu swayambur. Yatatat yatortan viradach chasvatibhya samabhya. Well, you all remember it. What it reminds me of is the tent campaigns when Parthasarathy Prabhu would get everyone to chant Hare Krishna and then draw it out. Everyone, no one knows really when to stop. Or yes, anyway, okay. Such a person must factually know the greatest of all, the personality of Godhead, who is unembodied, omniscient, beyond reproach, without veins, pure and uncontaminated, the self-sufficient philosopher who has been fulfilling everyone's desire since time immemorial. So the difference here between 8 and 6 and 7, although it's, you know, the same idea in the sense of describing the consciousness and position of the very advanced devotee, but the difference is that 6 and 7 are talking more about how the advanced devotee is seeing and relating with other living entities, basically, like that. Seeing everyone, everything in relation to the Lord, all living entities as his parts and parcels, seeing the Lord within everything, and then seeing all living entities as spiritual sparks in quality, one with the Lord. That's 6 and 7. But 8, it's more how he sees the Lord. That's the difference. Okay, so these are nice verses, important verses, because they're elaborating on the different symptoms, different qualifications of the different levels of devotees, particularly as we see in the beginning of the purport of Mantra 6. Srila Prabhupada is saying that this is a description of the Mahabhagavat, most advanced devotee. And then in that same paragraph, Srila Prabhupada starts talking about the different levels of devotees. Now I would assume that you are more or less familiar with these three different levels of devotees, Kanishta Adhikari, Madhyam Adhikari, and Uttama Adhikari. Now, are any of you not really familiar with the implications of these terms? Or if I ask any of you right now, what is a Kanishta Adhikari, can you tell me? Oh well, let's hope you can. I don't really intend going at much length, at least, into these things. We'll see in the first paragraph on page 44, Prabhupada is talking about the Kanishta Adhikari, materialistic devotee, doesn't see Krishna everywhere. In fact, only really sees Krishna in the temple, or church or mosque. In other words, Muslims and Christians may also be Kanishta Adhikaris. It's interesting when you try to apply these Krishna conscious concepts into other schools of thought, because these Krishna conscious concepts are not, they're not sectarian. They're actually universal realities. So it's interesting to consider, like here we're considering in this purport Prabhupada is talking about the different symptoms of the different levels, these three different levels. So it's interesting to look into other traditions and see how they manifest. And we can see that definitely in other traditions there are many Kanishtas. There are definitely many Kanishtas. They're very sectarian. They're very sectarian. My God is better than your God. Like that. And in order to show it, I may just go and smash your God. This is a popular idea amongst the Kanishta Adhikaris. Within our own world of Krishna consciousness, sometimes we see the idea of, with all due respect, my guru is better than your guru. So just see. Oh, there's so many things that go on within our little world, aren't there? All sorts of intriguing things. Maybe someday we should have a course identifying the different popular misconceptions, and trying to kind of clarify them and so on and so forth. Anyway, Kanishta Adhikari is like that. They're materialistic. That in a sense is the main problem, the root of the problem. They think they're their bodies to at least a large extent. They're still fixed in those, the old concepts from the old days, before they actually started getting involved in spiritual life. So therefore, they are applying certain of the common conceptions or misconceptions that exist within material life, they apply them into spiritual life. Like this very competitive idea, my religion is better than your religion, as they say, keeping up with the Joneses. That, if your next door neighbors get a better TV set, you have to get a better one also. That sort of thing. Prabhupada talked, in fact, about the materialistic householders, that they try and stock up their houses with all sorts of various facilities and commodities of household life. And then they invite their friends. And their friends come and see, oh, what nice curtains you have. And, oh, what a nice lounge suite. And what a delightful, dining table. And what a beautiful iron. Leave it strategically positioned so they see it. So Prabhupada's saying that they have to invite their friends. Otherwise, what is the value of having all those things? You don't need fancy curtains. You just need something to, something decent at least. A place to sit where you can be comfortable. Because you don't need to lavish money out on, extravagant facilities. What an exquisite electric toothbrush. So, you got to keep ahead. So when people come into spiritual life as Kanishtas, they carry these same tendencies. What a nice religion I have. And look at your religion. Oh boy. You're a real flop. So this is material life. So sometimes the Kanishta Adhikaris, another Sanskrit term which is used to describe them, is Prakrita Bhakta, materialistic devotee. To a large extent, they're on the material platform. So anyway, we could have a whole course about the three levels, or even just about Kanishta Adhikaris, practically. You know, they do all sorts of things, like they're still prone to identify with or place importance upon material qualification. So therefore they can be easily impressed by people who have material qualification. And if a devotee is very simple and humble and, you know, materially unsophisticated, then they may too easily sort of discredit the devotee and not take the devotee seriously. So there are all sorts of tendencies. I remember when George Harrison, the famous musician, came to visit Srila Prabhupada once in 1976. Then, of course, everyone knew, I mean, it was like an official visit. So all the devotees were there. And as George Harrison was being shown around, he would go, you know, around this way, that way, and around here, and they're seeing different things. And just around the corner behind, as he moved on to the next spot, was a whole crew of devotees looking around the corner. Oh, there he goes. Then he'd go around to the next place and they'd follow him around. So, yeah. Anyway, Kanishta Adhikaris are like that. And in terms of mantra 6, in terms of mantra 6, in which it's being stated that the Uttama Adhikari, the Mahabhagavat, the top class devotee, is seeing everything in relation to the Supreme Lord, and all living entities as part and parcel, and seeing the Supreme Lord within everything and everywhere. The Kanishta, in terms of this particular point, the Kanishta is really not seeing like that at all. The Kanishta is only seeing Krishna or God in the temple, and as soon as they get out of the temple, then, you know, God, he can't see me anymore. I don't really have to worry about him until I come back to the temple. And then I have to sort of be on my toes a bit. We find this often in other religions that, you know, you probably heard Prabhupada, in fact, talked about on a number of occasions. The practice that the Catholics have of confession, that you come in on, I think it's Saturday or whenever it is, and you just sort of let it all gush out, all the junk that you accumulated in the last week, all the rubbish that you did, and the priest behind the curtain, he's not meant to see who you are, but then he somehow or other has some sort of power of attorney to let you off. So, kind of convenient on a certain level, but we don't really think it works. So, one devotee, you may have heard this story before, but one of our devotees in Italy, he's now an old man, very nice devotee, he was a Catholic priest, and this was his duty, to hear the confessions. And at one point, just before he became a devotee, he was posted to a remote area where he was the only priest in the church. So he had to do everything, including hear the confessions of everyone and live there with everyone in the same village. So, of course, there's the curtain there, so you can't see the person, so it's not embarrassing and you can't blackmail them or something like that. But living in the village for several years, when people would come and confess, he would be able to tell who it was by the sound of their voice. He would know, oh, this is Mr. Such and Such. He's done it again. So, in the end, he knew every person and all the rotten stuff they were doing. And he could see that we're doing this confessions thing, but it's not working. It's not working. They keep coming back every week, or at least every month or so, with the same story about, you know, I'm really sorry, but... yeah, I did the same old thing again. So it wasn't working. So he became a devotee. Another story I heard very recently, just last year, was that one devotee, they were in Europe, they were doing book distribution, and there was a big Catholic church in the town. And he needed a place during the middle of the day. He was feeling very tired, so he went to take rest quietly in some corner of this big church. And he couldn't find a place. People were coming in and out. Then he saw this little sort of cupboard thing on the side with curtains. And he thought, well, that's a quiet little spot. So he went in behind the curtains, and he was basically taking rest. Then suddenly he heard, you know, like, Padre, or priest, or whatever they say, Reverend, we're here. And he was behind the curtain. He said, oh, really? what can I do for you? And he said, well, I've come to make my confession. Oh, okay, go ahead. So he stayed there for about an hour or two hearing confessions and telling people, oh, yes, oh, boy, that's really bad. But I tell you what, just chant the names of God. Try that. And because the priest has to offer some remedial thing. And then he snuck out afterwards. Anyway, these are the Kanishta Adhikaris. We don't really... I mean, they have their place, but they're not to be taken too seriously. Then Prabhupada goes on to talk about in the next paragraph, the madhyams. We, incidentally, are meant to be madhyams or trying to become. And I don't know if you've come to that in the Nectar of Instruction yet, but it's explained in verse 5, how Prabhupada explains how in ISKCON, when our devotees get initiated, particularly second initiated, they are meant to have come to the Madhyam Adhikari platform. They're meant to have shown that by their actions, that they are now on that platform, particularly for second initiation. And the authorities, the temple president, and the spiritual master, they're meant to look and examine in these terms. So there's a very kind of very specific test for Madhyam Adhikari, and Prabhupada mentions it here, that the Madhyam Adhikari is meant to see four types of person and respond in four different ways. So they're listed out here. He's meant to see the Supreme Lord, or, you know, at least appreciate that Krishna's there, and respond by always serving Krishna. Not like the Kanishta, who only sees Krishna in the temple and only responds, you could say, in the temple. So the Madhyam is meant to appreciate Krishna's presence everywhere and respond by always serving Krishna. Not, you know, sometimes we use this term part-time devotee. You may have heard it. I mean, as it has been applied historically, I would say it's not very nice, actually. But there may, we would apply it, I think at least it was applied, to devotees who live at home. And, you know, they have to work and stuff like that. So it's not really appropriate to a sincere householder who is actually trying to be Krishna conscious always. Part-time devotee would mean that sometimes you're a devotee, and what, sometimes you're a demon or something. Or sometimes you're not a devotee. You know, like that. Sometimes you're chanting Hare Krishna and following the regulative principles, but then you go and have a hamburger or something like that. So anyway, Madhyam Adhikari, that may be a Kanishta. Kanishta, it's not expected that a Kanishta would necessarily follow the regulative principles. But Madhyam, within this concept of seeing Krishna everywhere and responding, that would mean that the Madhyam is always fit. So anyway, Madhyam Adhikari, that may be a Kanishta. Kanishta, it's not expected that a Kanishta would necessarily follow the regulative principles. But Madhyam, within this concept of seeing Krishna everywhere and responding, that would mean that the Madhyam is always fixed in Krishna consciousness. Always. Then second, the Madhyam sees the devotees.
and responds. Not, you know, like this clique idea, or the, you know, I only spend time with my God brothers or God sisters, and the others, well, you know, we don't really bother with them too much. But the Madhyam identifies with the devotees, appreciates the devotees always, and responds by relishing the association of the devotees and always keeping the association at least as much as possible. And three, the Madhyam sees the innocent, materialistic people, but they're not envious. They're just, you know, like confused people. They don't have any like big, nasty attitudes, but they just don't know what's the truth. Like that. So the Madhyam sees the innocent and responds. Doesn't just see and say, okay, well there they are. But the Madhyam responds by preaching. And that preaching, of course, can take many forms. Book distribution, actually speaking to people directly as such. Prasadam distribution, assisting with the preaching from behind the scenes. Whatever it may be. But the basic idea is that someone who's really a Madhyam and who's actually developed that consciousness of seeing the innocent for what they are in terms of Krishna consciousness will respond by doing something. And, you know, really doing something, actually. Really seriously trying to help with the spreading of Krishna consciousness. And then for the atheists, so the Madhyam sees the atheists, those who are staunch non-devotees and who are actually antagonistic to Krishna consciousness and to devotees, and the Madhyam has nothing to do with these people. Nothing to do with them. Other than, if possible, to give them some mercy in some way. It may take some cleverness. You may have to be a little tricky. Because these people, if they know that this is something religious, then just on principle, because they're antagonistic to religion, they may say, oh, no, if it's religious, I won't touch it. Like that. So the real Madhyamadhikari then is, in order to help these atheists, of course you can just ignore them, and that can be there. But the real Madhyamadhikari, or good Madhyamadhikari, is thinking even how to get these atheists to take Krishna consciousness, somehow or other. And will even trick them. Like Lord Chaitanya, he took Mayavad Sannyas. Mayavad Sannyas. In order to trick these people. Okay, so that's Kanishta and Madhyam. And then there are the Uttamas. And the Uttamas, Mahabhagavats, top class, first class devotees, they're really on a very high level, and the verse itself was describing them. I'll read a little bit from the third paragraph, starting at the bottom of page 44. Above the Madhyamadhikari is the Uttama Adhikari, who sees everything in relation to the Supreme Lord. Such a devotee does not discriminate between an atheist and a theist, but sees everyone as part and parcel of God. He knows that there's no essential difference between a vastly learned Brahman and a dog in the street, because both of them are part and parcel of the Lord, although they're encaged in different bodies on account of the different qualities of their activities in their previous lives. He sees that the Brahman particle of the Supreme Lord, in other words, someone who's in the mode of goodness, that such a person has not misused his little independence given by the Lord. Of the Brahman and the dog, the Uttama Adhikari tries to do good to both. Such a learned devotee is not misled by material bodies, but is attracted by the spiritual spark within them. So Uttama Adhikari is very elevated and is seeing this. There's a sense of oneness there, ekatvam. This word is used in the next verse actually. Ekatvam means oneness. Uttama Adhikari is seeing that. A oneness between all living entities, men, women, doesn't make such a big discrimination. Even as stated here, a Brahmin, very qualified person, and a dog, doesn't make a big distinction. But as Prabhupada points out, it's an interesting point. it's not just like some empty-headed type of sense of oneness, but it's a real perception on the spiritual platform. And actually, the Uttamadhikari is seeing the fact, as Prabhupada says here, that the Brahman particle has not misused his independence, but the dog particle has. So he sees that. He does see that. But he doesn't really react so strongly. He just tries to help everyone. But he'll try to help in very relevant terms. Sometimes we hear the idea that the Uttama Adhikari doesn't preach. You've heard that idea? Yeah? Some of you, I hope. I don't want to start discussing something you're not familiar with, but sometimes it's said like that, that the Uttama Adhikari doesn't preach because, one, he feels himself to be very lowly, so he feels himself unqualified. Second, because he's feeling very lowly, he feels that everyone else, even the materialists, are more advanced than him. So on one hand, he feels that I couldn't preach. That even if there was a need to, actually all these people are very elevated, so there's no need to preach to them. Even just ordinary people. There's no need. And even if there was a need, I couldn't do it because I'm not qualified. So sometimes we hear a description of Uttama Adhikari like that. And some of our great acharyas in the past, they acted like that. Like Gaur Kishore Das Babaji. He refused to accept a disciple and was only, well, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was the only disciple he accepted. And he only accepted him when Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was actually about to commit suicide. He was actually going to do it. There was a bridge across one little like tributary of the Ganges, and Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, Gaur Kishore's ashram was on the other side, so Bhaktisiddhanta went over and requested him for the third time, and got refused for the third time, and then Bhaktisiddhanta started going back, and when he got to the middle of the bridge, he said that you please accept me, and if you don't, I'm going to jump off right now, actually. And he was serious. So then Srila Gaur Kishore Das Babaji accepted him. But otherwise, Gaur Kishore Das Babaji, as far as he was concerned, he thought that this is not for me. This is not for me to accept such a position. Let me just chant Hare Krishna and keep out of trouble. Just keep out of the way and just carry on with my own Krishna consciousness. This very elevated soul. There's another well-known case, one devotee, what was his name? Oh, I forget his name. But he was one of the followers of Lord Chaitanya, and Lord Chaitanya would tell him that you should accept a disciple. You know, don't just sit there and chant and just keep in solitude. You should do this. You should preach and help others. And the devotee would say, no, I can't do that. But Lord Chaitanya was insisting. So then one day he told Lord Chaitanya, all right, tomorrow morning, the first person I meet, I'll accept, whoever it is. So the next morning, he went to take bath in the Ganges early, before sunrise, it was still dark, and he was bathing and something bumped into him. And he couldn't see what it was, but then he made out, actually it's a dead body. It was a dead body. So he said, okay, I accept you as my disciple. Your name is now Murari. So the dead body came to life. And he became a famous devotee. Saranga Murari Thakur. Famous devotee. And lived on for many years. 50, 60 years he lived on. And became a famous preacher. He was a 12-year-old boy. And he died. And sometimes it happens in India that children, they don't burn the bodies. They put them in the Ganges. So his parents had done that. So a few weeks later, the parents found out that our son has come back to life somehow. So they went to the ashram to try and reclaim their son. But their son told them, nope,
Nope. That, you know, I was your son in my last life, but now he is my father, the spiritual master. So he just sent his parents home. And then he continued on to live for many years and become a famous devotee. Yeah, he was so famous he would go up to tigers and hit them in the face and tell them to chant Hare Krishna. And they would. Don't try doing that. I mean, don't even do it with a dog. You know? Just be careful. So the point I'm making is that Uttama Adhikaris, very elevated devotees, even though they have the sense of oneness and this feeling like they don't want to preach, but they may. And when they do, then it's really quite extraordinary. Just like a Madhyama Adhikari may try to spread Krishna consciousness. And he can spread it a bit. But Uttama Adhikari, when Uttama Adhikari spreads Krishna consciousness, then, oh, Krishna consciousness spreads in a big way. We may have difficulty, I mean, assuming we're Madhyama Adhikaris or something like that, maybe mixed Madhyam Kanishta perhaps, then we may have trouble, you know, keeping ourselves Krishna conscious. Do any of you have that experience? We may have trouble keeping ourselves Krishna conscious. What to speak about making the whole world Krishna conscious. But when an Uttama Adhikari preaches, the whole world becomes Krishna conscious. Because, you know, we're talking about a much higher level. It's not just like step one is Kanishta Adhikari, step two is Madhyam, step three is Uttama, and there you go. Not really. The Uttama is very high level of consciousness. Anyway, that's a little bit about the Uttama Adhikari. Prabhupada makes the point then on page 45, then right in the middle of the page, that paragraph. He says, don't try to imitate, particularly the sense of oneness that the Uttama Adhikari has, of not discriminating so much, being willing to give anyone Krishna consciousness, even the demons, if he feels in the mood. Don't imitate that. You know, it's quite popular amongst pseudo-spiritualists to try to imitate this elevated state of consciousness. But it comes out perverted. Like this idea of Daridra Narayan. Are you familiar with that? Or service to man or service to God, that idea? It's all one, you know, you should help everyone and see God in everyone, right? Service to man is service to God. Prabhupada explained, there's one conversation that he's debating with some fellow who thinks that service to man is service to God, and this is like the way to go. And don't worry about service to God in a direct sense. So Prabhupada was saying that, well, if you think service to man is service to God, then if they're the same, the two types of service, that means that service to God is service to man, isn't it? If half a dozen and equals six, then six equals half a dozen. So then Prabhupada asked, so if service to man is service to God, that means service to God is service to man, then what's better? To serve man or serve God? And then Prabhupada made the point, you try and serve man like all of humanity, there's 5 billion of them to start off with, and you try and serve them and really make them happy, and I tell you, it's not easy. Even sometimes when we go out doing food for life, sometimes they complain. It's too spicy, you know, can't we have something different, or, you know, something like that. So to serve man is really not easy. I mean, in the sense of actually serving them nicely, so they're very happy and you've successfully served them, all 5 billion of them. Even serving one of them is hard. Any of you who happen to have a husband or a wife might have had experience of that yourselves. It's tough. Now you can go out of your way and they're not satisfied. But to please Krishna, to please God, Krishna says, Patram Pushvam Palam Toyam, Yome Bhaktya Prayachati. You just offer, with devotion, one leaf You don't even need two. Just one leaf, one flower, one fruit, a little water, with devotion, and Krishna will be very happy, extremely happy. In fact, he'll become indebted. For one leaf, he'll become indebted if it's offered with devotion. We gave the example yesterday of Vidura, right, and his wife, and the banana skins. So this is the principle involved, working there, the principle of bhakti. So Prabhupada's making that point, that service to God is so much more effective, so much easier. So serve God. If you want like the easy way out, then serve God. So this pseudo-spiritualist's idea of oneness is really bogus. You know, yata mata tata pata. I don't want to mention any slogans which, you know, you might think that we're criticizing any particular person, but for every man, any person can choose their own path. And that's fine. We say that's fine because as long as you're happy with your path, even if it's totally different from my path, doesn't matter. If it's God for you, then that's good enough. But Prabhupada shot down that idea by saying that if your religion is to kill me, as in India, the assassins, it was their religion. Their religion was human sacrifice. So if your religion is to kill me, and I'm very much in this oneness mood, and it's all one, you can do what you like, and it doesn't matter, it's all one, it's all religion, it's all God. So if your religion is to kill me, then I would have to say, sure, practice your religion. Go ahead. Yeah. So we should avoid that. Then, let's see. Prabhupada makes the point. Anyway, let's go to Mantra 7, I think. In Mantra 7, the same idea is being continued, that a person who's seeing like this will have no illusion or anxiety. Previous verse said that the result was that he didn't hate anyone. This verse is saying there's no illusion or anxiety, no lamentation. Prabhupada explains in the purport that the materialistic society is based on illusion. And when you live a way of life based on illusion, what is the result? Lamentation. Because obviously it'll just be a mess if it's all based on illusion. Totally like counterproductive. So such a devotee then has no illusion and no lamentation, no anxiety. Now it's interesting here in the purport of Mantra 7, Prabhupada extends the scope of the persons who may have this consciousness. In the previous Mantra 6, the idea was it's the Mahabhagavats, the Uttama Adhikaris. They're the people who have this type of consciousness and who are seeing like this and feeling like that. But here in the purport, you'll see right there at the beginning that Prabhupada says, except for the Madhyam Adhikari and Uttama Adhikari, discussed above, no one can correctly see. So the point here is that the Madhyam Adhikari, or a good Madhyam Adhikari, should also be seeing in this way. The difference is that the Uttama Adhikari is seeing by direct realization. In other words, spontaneously. It's just how he sees things. But the Madhyam Adhikari, he's seeing like this on the basis of training. He's trained to think in a certain way, and see in a certain way, and respond in a certain way. So in a more, not like in a spontaneous sense, that it's, you know, just part of his being, but in the sense that he's well trained. So he, you know, he thinks, okay, here is this situation, so how should I see it? Well, I should see it like this. So in that deliberate sense, he sees that, you know, here's a Brahmin and here's a dog,
as according to the example given by Prabhupada in the previous purport. So then he thinks, well, actually, you know, in Bhagavad Gita, it says that they're all spirit souls. So I'll see them and I'll relate with them like that and not get too caught up on the bodily platform. So in that deliberate sense, that sense of being trained, the Madhyama Adhikari also sees in the same way and as a result experiences the same things, meaning not hating any living entity, as in Mantra 6 and in Mantra 7, not being an illusion, and as a result of not being an illusion, not lamenting. So that's an interesting point. If you come to the platform of being a proper Madhyamadhikari, then you'll be like that. So the verse itself says, Mantra 7, that it says, Ekatvam anupasyata. Oh, incidentally, just regarding the Madhyamadhikari, this term anupasyata or anupasyati is important. Pasyati means see, or he sees. Pasyami, pasyasi, pasyati. I see, you see, he or she sees. So pasyati means he or she sees. Anu means following. So the Mahabhagavat is more like pasyati. He's directly seeing in a very natural and spontaneous way. But anupasyati, seeing through following, this more applies to the Madhyamadhikari. Following meaning in the sense of accepting the philosophical concepts and adopting them as one's outlook on life. We call this sometimes Shastra Chakshus. You may have heard this term. Shastra Chakshus. Shastra means scripture and Chakshus means eyes or vision. Seeing through the eyes of scripture means that Lokabandhu Prabhu is sitting here. Very nice. He looks like a gentleman, a human being. But Shastra Chakshus means we know, oh, spirit soul. So we don't just say, well, look, you know, there's Lokabandhu there. He's a gentleman. There's some ladies sitting there. They're women. But Shastra Chakshus means they're spirit souls. And this is how we look on them. This is how we relate to them. This is how we respond to them in terms of that Shastra Chakshus, not just the superficial vision on the material platform. So, anyway, to get back to Ekatvam, the verse is saying that Ekatvam Anupasita, this person, particularly the Mahabhagavat in a spontaneous sense, or the Madhyam Adhikari in like the sense of being trained, that they see oneness. Now what is the nature of that oneness? We are not Mayavadis, we're not impersonalists. So there's a certain understanding to this concept of oneness, and it's explained on page 50, the bottom, the last paragraph there, and going over to page 51, that whole paragraph, is talking about Ekatvam. That the idea is, it's not just that we see, you know, any two human beings like they're one, meaning they're exactly the same. On the material platform, it's not possible because there is no such thing as oneness on the material platform. And even spiritually, the sense of oneness is only in certain respects, but we remain individuals spiritually also. Here, Prabhupada explains the concept of oneness in a very interesting way. He says that this oneness is in the sense of having the same interests. The same interests. So what is that interest? What is the main interest which is shared? That is Krishna's enjoyment. Krishna wants to enjoy. Now, if anyone, I mean, generally amongst the devotees, if someone comes and says, you know, I really want to become a big enjoyer, then we would say, well, look, hang on a minute. You know, you can enjoy in Krishna consciousness, but if you want to go out of your way to get enjoyment, then this is kind of materialistic. So, but Krishna, he is thinking
I want to enjoy in a big way. And the devotee thinks, very good. So Krishna wants to enjoy, and oneness, this oneness occurs with the devotees in the sense that the devotee accepts Krishna's desire to enjoy himself as the devotee's desire. The devotee's desire becomes, I want to help Krishna enjoy. So there's oneness. That is the sense of oneness. And all other forms of oneness in Krishna consciousness come out of that, actually. It all comes out of that. In fact, Bhaktivinoda Thakur gives a very interesting description that through accepting this form of oneness, accepting Krishna's desire to enjoy as my desire, to help him enjoy, a devotee, what to speak of becoming one, he becomes more one than one. How does that sound? He becomes more one than one. Now what does that mean? That means that Krishna wants to enjoy. And the devotee understands that. Or let me give an example. Lord Chaitanya, his enjoyment was to see that Krishna consciousness was spread, basically. That was his particular mode of enjoyment. So Lord Nityananda, he understood that. So therefore, as a devotee, he tried to fulfill that desire by getting people to become Krishna conscious. Then there was the incident of Jagai and Madai. You remember that. They were really demoniac. And in the end, they attacked Lord Nityananda, and Lord Chaitanya came, and he was going to kill them. But Lord Nityananda said, no, don't kill them. Deliver them. Give them Krishna consciousness. And Lord Chaitanya, eventually he agreed, all right, by your mercy, they can have Krishna consciousness. But if it was up to me, I would have killed them. Now, actually, it is Lord Chaitanya's desire that everyone become Krishna conscious. But in this situation, Lord Nityananda had accepted that desire of Lord Chaitanya's even more strongly than Lord Chaitanya held that desire. You follow the idea? So he was, in a sense, Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about this. He was more one than one. He was one in desire. But his version, his form of the desire, was stronger than Krishna's desire. So it's a superior form of oneness than just actually becoming one and merging. It's a superior form of oneness. So if any of you have any sort of lingering inclinations towards becoming one with God, then the best way you can achieve it is through Krishna consciousness. Okay? Through devotional service. Any comments or questions so far? Yes? Lord Chaitanya took Mayavad sannyas, that's a fact, from Keshav Bharati. He took sannyas, you know, he went and he accepted a sannyas guru, went through the ceremony, changed the cloth, shaved his head, took the danda, you know, he took sannyas, but from a Mayavadi. And he accepted Mayavad sannyas, yeah, but not like on the level of his heart and, you know, where he was at. No. But it was a trick.